Welcome to Michigan Writers on the Air, a program about writers, writing, reading, and listening here in northern Michigan. I'm Aaron Stander. On this edition of Michigan Writers on the Air, I'll be talking to author Marty Link about her true crime book, When Evil Came to Goodhart. The 10th anniversary edition has just been released by the University of Michigan Press. Then Carrie Noga will be here to talk about her new novel, The Orphaned Daughter. At the end, Fleeta Brown will provide an audio essay about the life and work of poet Donald Hall. Marty Link, one of the region's most celebrated and productive writers, is sitting across the table from me. Welcome, Marty.
Hi, Aaron.
You've had such a varied career as a writer. You started as a journalist, and then you did some true crime, and then you did memoir, and now we're talking about the anniversary of a book. That's quite amazing.
It is. It's rewarding to have a publisher stick with you that long in these days of, you know, everything just lasting for five, being important for 5 minutes, to have a publisher stay with you for a decade and then release an updated version of your first book is pretty rewarding.
And we're talking about the University of Michigan Press, and the book is When Evil Came to Goodhart.
Yes, and they asked me to write an afterword, which initially was going to just be a page long and some thoughts on the 10th anniversary edition. And I started writing all of the things that I had learned about the case since the book had been published, and the afterword is 10 pages. But that tends to be my MO. You know, I get started on something, and then I get interested, and then I go on a tangent, and then I find out more things.
And then it expands.
And then it expands into a book. So it's the same book that was published in 2008 with a 10-page afterword that's all new.
So let's go back to the 2008 book, and let's go back to the story, which happened 50 years ago.
Right. Yeah. In June of 1968, all six members of the Robison family were murdered inside their summer cottage, which is in Goodhart, Michigan, on the shores of Little Traverse Bay. And the crime wasn't discovered for 3.5 weeks. So that alone was a mitigating factor in the case not being officially solved. Although I think in the court of public opinion, the guilty person is known.
And this was a very personal story for you, right from the beginning.
It was, because I had heard news of the crime a day or so after it happened, or after a day or so after the bodies were discovered. I had heard news of the crime when I was in the back seat of the car with my family, and we were on vacation on the way to our cottage. And here's a little girl my exact same age that's just been murdered in her own cottage. So that story really stuck with me for years.
And sort of outline the crime, the family, the connections.
It was Richard and Shirley Robison. They were about to celebrate their 20th wedding anniversary. They had 4 children, Richie Jr., who was 18, Gary, 16, Randy, 12, and Susan, 8. And this was going to be the first summer that the family spent the entire summer up north in their cottage. It had been kind of a family dream for years, and Richard's advertising business was just to the point where it was successful enough that they were going to be able to do that. And as it turned out, they were there for 9 days before the crime happened. The day of the crime, Richard had been on the phone with his banker at the Bank of Detroit asking what happened to the $200,000 deposit that was supposed to be in his account. And the banker told him that deposit was never made. And after that, one of his employees didn't have an alibi, had just given himself a huge raise, and showed up a couple of days after the crime was discovered, acting very suspicious. So right from the beginning, he was a suspect.
So how did you get drawn to true crime?
Well, I have a journalism degree from Michigan State University. And my first job out of college was to be a police reporter for a small daily newspaper in New England. And so I got my chops on daily journalism, reporting basic criminality in a small town of Seacoast, New Hampshire. And then when I quit that job and moved back to Michigan to have my family, I still had all those skills. I just happened to have babies at home to take care of, and there was no place for those skills to go. And so I started reading a lot of true crime books and watching a lot of court TV. I don't know if you remember court TV, but I always think other mothers were probably watching soap operas, and here I am watching a lot of criminal trials. And then I looked for a book on the Goodhart case because I was still curious about it after all these years, and there was no book. So my advice to writers is always write the book that you want to read, because that is what worked for me.
And what was the process of writing this story? Because the case had been cold for decades.
It had. It was 2 years. I started writing 2.5 years before the 40th anniversary of the crime. And so I knew from my police reporter days that certain things were public information, and I just needed to fill out a Freedom of Information Act request. And I did that with Emmett County Sheriff's Office and also the Michigan State Police. Emmett County Sheriff's Office by that time had gotten so much interest over the years on the case that they had put the entire case file on a DVD. And it wasn't a DVD like you would play in a video player. It was a DVD just that had a lot of storage. Mm-hmm. Back then there wasn't memory sticks, or, you know, we've come a long way just in 10 years. And so I went to the Emmett County Sheriff's Office, and they said, "Oh yeah, for $50, we'll give you the DVD." And so I paid my $50, and I got the entire case file, Emmett County's version of the entire case file. Then I filed the same Freedom of Information Act request with the Michigan State Police, and I got a huge box of printed documents along with audio tapes and a giant folder of crime scene photos. So from there, I just started putting things in chronological order and picking up the phone and interviewing people and then getting in my car and driving north.
And how many months, years?
Yeah, it was about, I think, a year, maybe a year of research and a year of writing, and the two did overlap somewhat.
Now, you've done two crime books since then. Is that about the same timeline that you need to really research one of these?
You know, Aaron, it seems like with every book, it takes me longer. It takes me longer to decide on a story. It takes me longer to do the interviews. It takes me longer to do all of the research. And I'm not sure if I'm getting slower or if I'm more thorough or if I just, my attention span is longer and I'm more interested in all of the tangents. But When Evil Came to Goodhart took me 2 years. Isidore's Secret took me about 2.5 years. And then the third true crime book that I wrote, Wicked Takes the Witness Stand, took me almost 6 years.
So you got all the information, you laid it out, you wrote the book. But interestingly enough, you had a publisher before you wrote page one.
That is the thing with nonfiction that you can do. If you're writing a novel, you pretty much have to have the whole thing done before you get a publisher. But with nonfiction, you can write something called a proposal and send it to the publisher or an agent if you had an agent, which I didn't at that time. And they decide based on that proposal, which includes a sample chapter and a bio about you and how you think you're going to market the book, they can decide and give you a publishing contract just based on that proposal. Now, my proposals run 50 pages, so it feels like I might as well just write the book.
But you were surprised because when you went and looked for a publisher, you found the University of Michigan website.
I did.
And you had no idea what a proposal was.
Right, I didn't. I thought that I didn't have enough time. I only had 2 years to write the book and get it published before the anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the crime. And I knew that around that 40th anniversary, there would be attention paid, and that would be a good time to be releasing a book on the case. And so I looked around for Michigan-based publishers, and I'm a Spartan, so that was the first place I looked. And at that time, Michigan State didn't have what you call trade books. They mostly had academic books. Today, they publish trade books, but back then, not so much. Then I looked at the Wolverines, and I looked at the University of Michigan, and they had published some trade books. They'd even published some fiction and some novels and histories, and I could see my book fitting in with the other books that they published. And so I went on their website and I found an email that was editor@uofmpress.gov. And so I just sent a blind email and I said, hi, this is who I am. This is my experience. And I would like to write a book on the Robison case. Are you interested in publishing that? And looking back, that isn't so incredibly naive, but I didn't know anything about the book publishing industry or how to go about it. And remarkably, I got a response in about an hour and 15 minutes. And I know that because I've saved all those email, all that email correspondence. When it comes to paperwork, I'm a complete hoarder. And so the response was, we might be interested in this. Send us a proposal. And I just sillily wrote back, what's a proposal? And luckily for me, the person on the other end of that email was a woman named Mary Irwin. And she was very patient and very understanding. And she directed me to a place on their website that told all about how to write a book proposal. And that might still be there. That place on their website might still be there. And so I wrote the proposal and I sent it in and they responded with a book contract.
And the rest is history.
I suppose.
And the proposal actually was the blueprint for the actual book.
It was, yeah.
So that worked out really well.
It did, yeah.
After the book was done, printed, and in the stores, you had a number of things happen which revealed a whole lot about this story. Could you talk about that?
Sure. And every journalist has a few humbling moments, and I'm about to tell you one of mine. I had looked for a man named Ed Goss while I was researching the book. And Ed Goss was the chief polygraph examiner in the late 60s for the Michigan State Police. And he had the suspect hooked up to what he called his apparatus at least twice, possibly three times. And so I really wanted to interview him and get his impressions before the book was published. And I was never able to find him. And so the book went to print without that interview, and it came out. So one of the first places that I talked about the book was on Ron Jolly's radio program on WTCM in Traverse City. And Ron was interviewing me, and the interview was going well, and I was a little bit nervous because it's my first book, and it's the first real publicity that I had done. And then all of a sudden, Ron said, okay, now we're going to open up the phones for callers. And I had no idea what to expect. And there were quite a few calls and people just asking basic questions about the case, mostly that I knew the answers to. And then there was this gruff voice on the other end of the line, and he said, my name is Ed Goss. I was the chief polygraph examiner during this case. I have some things to tell you, but I'm not going to say it on the air. So the producer took that phone call, and later Ed and I made a plan for coffee, and I did meet him for coffee, and he told me this story. He said that after he retired, and his retirement is the humbling part for me, he retired to Traverse City. I couldn't find the guy to interview for my book, and here he was in my own town. So if my head ever gets too big, I just return to that moment and how I felt hearing that. So anyway, he had retired and he was fishing and he had just pulled his boat up on shore. And I think it was 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon and his telephone rang and he wasn't there to answer it. But his high school age son was home from school and answered the phone. And the voice on the other end of the line said, is your dad there? And the teenage son said, no, but he's down at the lake. I'm happy to go get him if you can hang on a minute. And the voice said, no, just give your dad a message. Tell him this was Joe and that he was right. And that is the day that Joe Scalero, who was the chief suspect, committed suicide with a handgun that was similar to the handgun that was used to kill the Robisons. It was not the same gun, but it was the same model gun. And so, boy, would I have liked to have had that story when the original version of the book came out. But that is probably the centerpiece of the afterword, along with some other theories of mine and maybe ideas that I have for ways that the case could continue to be investigated. But that story was the one that just glued me to the chair. I couldn't. It made me realize that all of those people that thought that Joe was guilty were probably right.
So after that book, you did a couple more true crimes. Then you did a couple of memoirs. What are you going to do next?
Oh, that's a good question. The problem isn't that I don't have ideas. The problem is that I have too many ideas, and I have, you know, our lives are finite. So I'm to the age now where I really have to start choosing and being more careful in my choice, and also choosing something that I'm going to be interested in for a decade. Mm-hmm. What am I going to want to research for 2 or 3 years, write about for 2 or 3 years, and then talk about for another 4 or 5 years, maybe longer? And so I've never relinquished that interest in true crime, which to me is trying to apply a logical chronology to the illogical. I feel like that's where my skills lie. I have some investigative skills, and I have uncovered some things that maybe wouldn't have been uncovered otherwise, but I feel like my real skill is in applying that logic to something that, you know, most of us have no way of understanding. And so I have a couple of projects that I'm researching, and I'm to the point where I really have to choose between the two. But I have the itch, as I call it. I have the itch to get obsessed with another book project. And so that's probably what I'll be up to this winter. I will choose this winter.
So if listeners want to know more about your current books or perhaps your calendar of events or where you're teaching, where's a good place to look?
They can go to my website, which is martylink.com. And I also wanted to mention that because I have 50-year-old audio from the Goodhart case,
yes,
I have a limited version of a podcast. Right now it has 4 episodes. It'll probably eventually have 7 episodes. And you can hear the detectives interview the chief suspect. You can hear how they go about the investigation.
From the Goodhart case.
The podcast is called Up North Cold Case, and it's on iTunes.
Yes. And the link is right there on your website.
It is. Yes.
Marty, it's always a pleasure.
Oh, you as well, Aaron.
Hope to see you back soon with another book.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. I'm pleased to welcome Carrie Noga back to Michigan Writers on the Air. And Carrie, you were first on the program in 2005 when you talked about your first book-length manuscript, which was nonfiction and was titled
Road Biking Michigan.
And then we saw you 10 years later, and you had moved to fiction with a beautifully crafted novel, Sparrow Migrations. That book had an interesting path to publication. Would you tell our listeners your route to a national audience?
Sure. And thank you for having me. Sparrow Migrations started out as a National Novel Writing Month project. And that was that's where you attempt to write a book in a month. And I wrote the first draft of it in 2010 and attempted to publish it the traditional way. Find myself an agent who would find me a publisher. That did not work. Wound up with some interest, but ultimately all thanks but no thanks. So I self-published it in 2013. My 3 years after writing the manuscript, the self-published edition came out, and I really had fun with that. I tried all different kinds of means of promoting it, and one of those promotions put it in front of the eye of an editor at Lake Union Publishing, which is an imprint of Amazon Publishing. And she read it and was interested enough to make me an offer to re-release it, which is what happened in 2015. So yeah, it was a little bit of the Cinderella story, an author's Cinderella story, where your novel is plucked out to be lifted up and polished, worked with their editorial process to re-release it in 2015.
Today we'll be talking about your new book, The Orphan Daughter, a long and complicated novel. Orphan Daughter has two main characters, a 40-something woman and a girl just entering her teenage years. You provide the reader with two first-person narratives, present tense, I guess I should add. often your characters are thinking and talking about the same thing in adjacent chapters. Would you talk about the process of writing this? Did you do chapter after chapter? I mean, how did you structure it with these two narrative lines?
I did, yes. Jane is the 40-something woman, and Lucy is the 11-year-old who turns 12 during the course of the novel. I really wanted to try present tense and first person for this novel, just as a means of flexing writerly muscle. The Sparrow Migrations was written in third person past tense. It did have multiple perspectives, so that was something in common between the two. But this is first person. I think first person and present tense are really lend themselves to a youthful character, a child character, as Lucy is. So that made sense. And I also had read a novel, Room, in particular by Emma Donoghue, which was a mega bestseller made into a movie. That was written in first person, told from the point of view of a 5-year-old. And I was so captivated by that, that when I read that just before I started writing this, that was what really said yes, that pushed me to, I want to try this first person thing. I want to try the present tense. It draws the reader so much more into, the events of the novel. Kind of the trade-off, the risk, is that it can be a bit, you sometimes have to go through some minutia because, big major plot points don't happen in every day in between breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So it did take some wrestling with. At one point, I pulled all of Jane's chapters into one document. I had all of Lucy's chapters in another document to try to make them distinct, because that was another risk. Since both are female characters, even though they're different ages, they couldn't sound too much alike. But then ultimately, I blended them back together, alternating chapters. They both have very different takes on, Lucy is the orphan who must come and live with Jane. She doesn't want to do that. Jane has a very keen attachment to her home. And so, having Jane say, look, warmly or positively on something, and then to see Lucy's disdain or distaste, I really liked how that worked out.
So could you provide our listeners with just the bones of the story? I don't want you to give away too much, but...
Right, sure. So The Orphan Daughter is a story about grief. Both Jane and Lucy are wounded souls. Lucy's lost her parents in a car accident, and that causes her to have to move from her home in New York City to Old Mission Peninsula here in northern Michigan with her Aunt Jane, her mother's half-sister. And both of them are stubborn characters tend to nurse those wounds, but both ultimately learn that they have to move. They need each other to move forward in their lives, and helping them learn that is a third character, Miguel, and he is a former migrant worker who is now a full-time resident, and he shares Jane's love of the land. Jane runs a small farm, and he shares Lucy's half-Mexican heritage. So he is the bridge figure between Jane and Lucy, helping them decide whether they can forge a family together.
Could you read a bit from the novel?
Sure. I'd love to. So I'm going to read from a chapter that's pretty far into the book, about two-thirds. So, I don't want to be a spoiler either, but as I said, Jane and Lucy have had some sort of trials and tribulations up to this point. The novel spans from the spring of 2011 until the summer of 2012, and this is Thanksgiving time. Lucy is experiencing her first real snow after moving from New York City, and they've spent the holiday with a family, Rebecca and Paul, and their children, Jason and Jared. Jared in particular is an important character. He kind of befriends Lucy in the book. So they've had their Thanksgiving dinner, and they are going sledding now. This is told in Jane's point of view. Later, Rebecca produces a thermos of hot chocolate. Drinking it feels familiar, yet distant. Kids whiz down on all different sleds. Saucers, tubes, toboggans. Some sit up, some lie on their stomachs. Jason's got a snowboard. I'll bet it's been almost 10 years since I went sledding. How come? Rebecca asks. Well, Matt outgrew it, and that was that. He's an only child, then. I nod, waiting for the familiar pang that will tow me back 2 decades. Something stirs, but not so sharply. I don't feel disembodied, my mind reeled back to Alaska and the cruel mirror of the dark winter days. Instead, the sledding scene sharpens, the laughter louder, snow crunching under boots, steam rising from my hot chocolate and curly cues, Rebecca talking while she pours 2 more cups. Excuse me? I said, it's too bad, isn't it, that you need kids to give you permission to play? She nods at Lucy and Jared, charging up the hill again. They take her cocoa cups and collapse, cheeks pink, mittens matted with snow. Look who's talking. Neither of you have gone down yet, Paul says, reaching for Rebecca's thermos. Oh, come on now, Paul. She backs away, shaking her head. Come on, nothing. You need permission to play? Look, plenty of sleds available. He manages to grab the thermos from her, then turns to me. I'll hold your cup, Jane. What? No. Instinctively, I shake my head. My back. Back schmack. This'll do your soul a world of good. You can go together. Go on, Mom, Jared says, starting up a chant. Go, Mom. Go, Mom. Lucy picks it up. Go, Aunt Jane. Go, Aunt Jane. Somehow, he coaxes Rebecca and me onto the toboggan, their longest sled. Room for one more, Paul says, looking at Lucy. All the ladies? Okay. Lucy swallows the last of her cocoa and stands up, no hesitation. She climbs on behind me, hands my shoulders, and Paul pushes us off. It feels like we hang on the brink forever, but then gravity does the inevitable, and we're flying down. Rebecca's scarf whipping in front of my eyes, Lucy's scream mixing with mine, half anticipation, half revelation, pure delight. Triple-loaded onto the toboggan, we zoom straight down instead of careening around the edge of the bowl, plowing into fresh, untouched powder, which finally stops us. Woohoo, Mom! Jared has followed us down on another sled. You went the farthest! I gaze at Lucy, laughing, exhilarated, traces of a cocoa mustache on her face, snow sparkling on the braids hanging below her hat, and then at the sled tracks. Jared's almost right. It's Lucy and I who have come the furthest.
Thank you. Karen Noga reading from The Orphan Daughter. In an exchange of emails, you describe Aunt Jane as being somewhat prickly, and you were worried that some readers might be turned off by that.
Yes. Yes, I was. And I mentioned she being a wounded soul. She is a mother of one, and she suffered a stillbirth years ago, that is her unresolved grief that has made her prickly. And that's what she's recalling in that scene when she thinks back to Alaska. That's where her daughter died. And she has protected herself in order not to incur, you know, such hurt and such grief again. And so she's developed, you know, that hard shell that you can, and or the prickles, you know, to ward mm-hmm. off others from being too close. And readers, especially with mother characters, can be less than understanding about that. You know, we all have, especially in America, the image of mothers and apple pie and how they are supposed to sacrifice and do everything for their children, put them first always. And so when Lucy enters the scene, you know, Jane has sort of finally come to be at peace with her life. Her one grown son is gone out of the home. Her marriage has ended, and she's finally okay by herself. And she nurtures her farm on Old Mission with the love that she fears investing in relationships. And then, boom, here comes Lucy. You know, it's another chance, but it's also a disruption, you know, at the busiest time of year for her farm. So she has to protect herself for a while longer before she can decide whether or not to let Lucy in, let herself love her. And so that's the prickliness.
Several of the characters are Mexican-American or natives of Mexico.
Yes.
And so there is a lot of Spanish in the text. It's not hard for the reader to follow because you make it very clear what they're saying. But your own background, how did you do this with great authenticity?
Well, I am verbally fluent, I would say, in Spanish. You know, I studied it going back to high school. I've traveled in Spain. I really enjoy languages. I considered studying those for a while instead of journalism, which was my ultimate college path. And in the book, you know, it's English speakers and speaking to Spanish speakers, so it's a Spanglish. To me, that also is the language is a way of revealing scene. It creates such texture to a conversation to have even just, you know, a couple words of a foreign language. If you use it too sparingly, though, it feels kind of careless, not purposeful. And so what the fine line that I had to tread was to use it in a way that was intentional and that someone who was a native speaker, in the case of the Mexican characters, would use, but make it translatable, you know, to a reader who might not. So I try to do that with having, if I have a Spanish line, then in the reply, you can infer what was asked or what was said in the Spanish dialogue. I had a couple test readers who were fluent in Spanish read it, and the publisher did a thorough Spanish language review. But I find that the language, I think, adds to the setting, adds and embellishes the setting in a non-fussy way. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it clutter up with a lot of adjectives?
Setting's a really important part of the story.
It is, yes.
It is as important as character, almost.
I think so. And it was just kind of funny to me because I am sort of impatient when as a reader with settings that I feel are overly done when they're described visually in particular at great length. I get it. You know, the antelope were stampeding across the plain. You know? Remembering one particular book. But yes, the setting also, you know, almost becomes a character. As I mentioned with Jane and her farm, it's instrumental in her healing. Living in Michigan is the first time she's lived in a place with four seasons that enables her to grow something. And when she sees what she grows thrive, her plants on her farm, that's incredibly healing to her when she feels like she fell so short as a mother and not nurturing her children adequately. So the setting is particularly important to Jane, and then it's jarring, you know, to Lucy, and it underscores all of her loss. You know, she comes from Manhattan, you know, to Old Mission, and there's not even buses, you know, to take her someplace, and so it almost serves a little bit as an antagonist to Lucy in that regard.
And readers will be familiar with most of the places described in the book because it's about our area.
Right. Yes. Yes.
And yet it's not so much about our area that anyone anywhere in the world can't connect with what you're talking about.
Yeah. I hope so.
Yeah. And you also do a lot with seasonal rhythms, but you sort of by metaphor are talking about the rhythms of life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Spring, summer, winter, fall. In a enterprise like a farm, of course, the seasons are very important. Jane is going through the seasons of her life. She's been a mother, and now she's an empty nester. Lucy is just embarking she'd be in the spring, is about to enter her teen years.
So what's next?
What's next?
This novel thing has become a regular part of your.
It has. Yes, I'm just starting, just dipping my toe into my next novel, and I'm going to take a page out of your book, Erin, and I'm going to try a series. Erin, probably many listeners know Erin's mystery series, and one of the things that I've learned with both books is it's very hard to, and time consuming, I guess I should say, more than anything, to invent characters and stories out of whole cloth. It's wonderful, it's fulfilling, when you're done with the end, there's nowhere to jump off from. So I have an idea for a series that I'd like to pilot as a three-book series, a little different than what I've done so far, but also featuring a female protagonist. The tagline I have in my head is Andrea O'Malley Saves the World. So I'll just tantalize you with that.
Wow.
And be back in a couple years, maybe hopefully sooner, to talk more about her.
So where are your books available, these two novels?
The two novels. Here in Northern Michigan, you can get them at Horizon Books and Brilliant Books, and also on Amazon. And there is a Kindle edition, paperback edition, and audio. And the audio and Kindle are only on Amazon.
If our listeners want more information about your work or your schedule of upcoming events, they can find it on your website at?
Yes, carrienoga.com. It's CARRINOGA.com.
Carrie Noga, thank you so much for being here, and congratulations on The Orphan Daughter. It's a wonderful read.
Thank you, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Michigan Writers on the Air on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm in the studio with Fleeta Brown. Welcome, Fleeta.
Hi, Aaron.
Over the years, we've talked a lot about Donald Hall, who died on June 24th. My memories of Donald Hall are so rich, not that I ever knew him, but my freshman year of college, Donald Hall showed up at Albion College with Robert Bly, and they read. And
wow.
It was the first time I ever saw a living poet, or two living poets at that moment. They'd always been dead white guys in anthologies before, and it was sort of a life-changing kind of incident for me. Later, I saw him in Ann Arbor. He had one of those English bikes. He wore a three-piece suit. He carried an old briefcase on the back of his bike.
This is hard to see Donald Hall in that.
Oh. I audited one of his classes on James Joyce. He stood in front of a group of undergraduates in his three-piece suit with a cigar, and in the voice of Dylan Thomas, read the Dublinder stories. And the last time I saw him in Ann Arbor was a hot, steamy morning of 1972. And he was not in a three-piece suit, but a pair of
overalls,
yeah, with a young woman in a pair of overalls. And I reflected on how much people changed during the 60s. And I know you have lots of memories of Donald Hall, but you actually knew him.
Yes. And I will tell you a little bit. I have maybe not lots of memories, but I have some impressions. And when I knew him, it was the a little bit later, clean-shaven, kind of regular guy-looking Donald Hall, which lasted quite a while before. In these latter years, he sort of became Walt Whitman and grew his hair out long. But, you know, that's not important. I want to talk about Donald Hall, the poet. And I'm not picking one book out of his 28 books. I'm not, plus 14 children's books. Isn't that interesting? So I just wanted to just sort of reflect a little bit and talk about Donald Hall as a poet. He grew up in Connecticut. He said that his early love of monster movies led him into reading Edgar Allan Poe. And he said at that point he decided he was going to spend the rest of his life writing poetry. And this was back in probably high school. He said devoted 1 to 2 hours every day writing poetry. He said he never stopped. So I want to read you a poem, since we don't want to just talk about Donald Hall, but actually hear something from him. Plays with the fact that in Detroit you can buy frozen rats to feed your pet boa constrictor. And he carries that to really crazy extremes. Maybe it's greed, or maybe it's just about the strangeness of our lives. It's called Poem with One Fact. At pet stores in Detroit, you can buy frozen rats for 75 cents a piece to feed your pet boa constrictor back home in Grosse Pointe or in Grosse Pointe Park, while the free nation of rats in Detroit emerges from alleys behind pet shops, from cellars and junked cars, and gathers to flow at twilight like a river the color of pavement, and crawls over bedrooms and groceries and through broken school windows to eat the crayon from drawings of rats. And no one in Detroit understands how rats are delicious in Dearborn. If only we could communicate. If only the boa constrictors of Southfield would slither down I-94, turn north on the Lodge Expressway, and head for 8th Street to eat out for a change. Instead, tomorrow, a man from Birmingham enters a pet shop in Detroit to buy a frozen German Shepherd for $6.50 to feed his pet cheetah, guarding the compound at home. Oh, they arrive all day in their locked cars, buying schoolyards, bridges, buses, churches, and ethnic festivals. They buy a frozen Texaco station for $84.50 to feed to an imported London taxi in Huntington Woods. They buy Tiger Stadium frozen to feed to the Little League in Grosse Isle. They bring everything home frozen solid as pig iron to the six-car garages of Harper Woods, Grosse Pointe Woods, Farmington, Grosse Pointe Farms, Troy, and Grosse Arbor, and they ingest everything and fall asleep and lie coiled in the sun while the city thaws in the stomach and slides to the small intestine, where enzymes break down molecules of protein to amino acids, which enter the cold bloodstream. Isn't that astounding?
Amazing and fun.
Well, things to know about Donald Hall. Along with Robert Frost, he was a student at Breadloaf Writers Conference. He earned degrees at Harvard and Oxford and was the first poetry editor of the very prestigious Paris Review. And as you said, he spent years teaching at the University of Michigan before he moved back to New England with the poet Jane Kenyon, who was his second wife. He rebought his great-grandfather's farm at Eagle Pond. He called it Eagle Pond Farm in Connecticut. So they had the most idyllic poet life. They'd write all morning. They'd separate, write all morning, sometimes part of the afternoon. They'd take walks and play ping pong, and it was just, a writer's life that anybody could dream of having. So I have a poem about Eagle Pond Farm. It's not a happy poem. It's not about idyllic times. It's typical melancholy, which is Donald Hall, if you know anything about his work. What I notice, though, is that the awful scene in a photograph he remembers leads him back to the pond on the farm, and life is warming there at the pond. At Eagle Pond. In April, the ice rots. Over the pocked glaze, puddles of gray stain spread at midday. Every year, an ice fisherman waits one weekend too many, and his shack sinks to remain among reeds and rowboats. At this open winter's end, in the rack and melt of early spring, I walk on the shore of Eagle Pond, by our August swimming place, and count the season's waste. Mostly the wakeful beavers work, stout trees chewed through, stripped of bark, trailing twigs in the water. Come summer, we will chop the rot away and loll on red blossoms of moss. In October, I came here last, walking beside my daughter, whose red hair flared under poplar's pale yellow, under black-green fur. I gazed at her watery, pale profile, admiring the forehead, large and clear, without guile, and took pleasure in her silent company. By the shore, a maple stood upright, casting red leaves gnawed to a 3-inch waist of centerwood that bore the branch's weight. Today it has eaten down new blonde splinters within the gray surface of the old chewing. 2 weeks ago, I drove her to the hematology clinic of Peter Bent Brigham Hospital and waited outside among bald young women and skeletal boys. By the felled maple, my frightened heart is wary of reassurance. From 40 years back, I remember a photograph of the German regular army hanging partisans on the Russian front. Grandfather Wehrmacht, in his tight-collared greatcoat, adjusts the boy's noose while his elderly adjutant watches beside the boy his girl companion has already strangled, her gullet cinched when a soldier kicked a box from her feet. In the photograph taken near Minsk the summer of 1941, the boy smiles as if he understood that being hanged is no great matter. At the pond's edge, old life warms from the suspense of winter. Fish hover under the corrupt surface of April ice, and everything trembles in the moment's skin and surge, grasping nothing, wishing only to fall as the stone wishes, or to rise with the wish of fire. I separate into sky as a bird, into water as a fish, or as water itself, or as weeds that waver and rotter. Isn't that amazing?
Amazing.
Just takes us everywhere in one poem. Donald Hall writes a lot, has written a lot about the illness and death of his wife, Jane, from leukemia. And one thing you can always be sure of with Donald Hall is that life will be closely chronicled. He's like a journalist poet, but with a very sophisticated mastery of his craft. He was a true intellectual. He wrote several really good books about writing. He was also a huge baseball fan, I should add. He wrote an amazing poem called Baseball, which I will not read. He had really high standards. He dismissed an awful lot of poems as what he called McPoems, a billion served. Here's one of his favorite quotes. True ambition in a poet seeks fame in the old sense to make words that live forever. He said he didn't see any reason to spend your life writing poems unless your goal was to write great poems. So I knew him when I was teaching at the University of Delaware, and he was there at least twice visiting as a visiting poet for several reasons. He seemed to like my poems, and we set up a correspondence. He'd send me his poems for critique, and I sent him mine. I realized, of course, that, you know, he was mostly sending me his so that I wouldn't feel intimidated. It was pretty clear that he was going to be the one helping me. He commented on everything I sent. He would write these pithy little letters. They were always very encouraging. He was particularly fierce about what he called dead metaphors, one that are any collection of phrase, any collection of words that were recognizable, familiar, so that the ear doesn't hear them anymore. I found out later that he corresponded with so many fledgling writers that he spoke his comments into a little recorder and had a secretary type them up. No matter, he taught me a lot. When my first book was accepted, I wrote to him all excited, and he responded with congratulations, but he said, apropos of the quote I just read you, that I must keep my eye on the goal, good poems. He said, don't get caught up in prizes and publications. There will never be enough. If you win the Pulitzer, there will always be something else. So I'll end with a poem, a couple of tiny poems. One that shows pretty much how he felt about creative writing programs. It's called For an Early Retirement. Chinless and slouched, gray-faced and slack of jaw, here plods depressed Professor Peckinpah, whose verse J. Donald Adams found exciting. This fitted him to teach creative writing. So the last one is just another little short poem that is just a perfect picture, I think, of Donald Hall, the way he'd like us to see him at the end. Apology for old clothes. Cerulean tweed jacket, 20 years old, that blueprints the pitch of my shoulders, cardigan out at the elbows, comfortable, unkempt, familiar as memory's attic after 50 years of collecting. I wear a shabby house, as the lazy turtle does, disreputable and easy, dozing in mud all winter.
And I can see him in the last few photographs of his life. They certainly fit with that poem.
Exactly, yes.
Thank you, Felita. We close this segment with Donald Hall in his own words. The poem is Kicking the Leaves.
Kicking the Leaves. This is a poem I wrote in Michigan just before Jane and I moved to the house in New Hampshire. And I knew we were going to come and camp out at any rate. And the poem really seems to know that I'm going to be moving in here and living here. It's a kind of farewell to the old life, looking forward to the new. Kicking the leaves, October, as we walk home together from the game in Ann Arbor, on a day the color of soot, rain in the air. I kick at the leaves of maples, reds of 70 different shades, yellows like old paper, and poplar leaves, fragile and pale, and elm leaves, flags of a doomed race. I kick at the leaves, making a sound I remember, as the leaves swirl upward from my boot and flutter. And I remember October's walking to school in Connecticut, wearing corduroy trousers that swished with a sound like leaves, and a Sunday buying a cup of cider at a roadside stand on a dirt road in New Hampshire, and kicking the leaves, autumn 1955 in Massachusetts, knowing my father would die when the leaves were gone. Each fall in New Hampshire, on the farm where my mother grew up, a girl in the country, my grandfather and grandmother finished the autumn work, taking the last vegetables in from the cold fields, canning, storing roots and apples in the cellar under the kitchen. Then my grandfather raked leaves against the house as the final chore of autumn. One November I drove up from college to see them. We pulled big rakes, as we did when we hayed in summer, pulling the leaves against the granite foundations, around the house, on every side of the house. And then, to keep them in place, we cut spruce boughs and laid them across the leaves, green on red, until the house was tucked up, ready for snow that would freeze the leaves in tight like a stiff skirt. Then we puffed through the shed door, taking off boots and overcoats, slapping our hands, and sat in the kitchen, rocking, and drank black coffee my grandmother made, three of us sitting together, silent, in gray November. One Saturday, when I was little, before the war, my father came home at noon from his half day at the office and wore his bait sweater, black on red, with the crossed hockey sticks on it, and raked beside me in the backyard, and tumbled in the leaves with me, laughing, and carried me, laughing, my hair full of leaves, to the kitchen window, where my mother could see us and smile and motion to set me down, afraid I would fall and be hurt. Kicking the leaves today, as we walk home together from the game, among crowds of people with their bright pennants, as many and bright as leaves, my daughter's hair is the red-yellow color of birch leaves, and she is tall like a birch, growing up 15, growing older. And my son, flamboyant as maple, 20, visits from college and walks ahead of us, his step springing, impatient to travel the woods of the earth. Now I watch them, From a pile of leaves beside this clapboard house in Ann Arbor, across from the school where they learn to read, as their shapes grow small with distance, waving. And I know that I diminish, not them, as I go first into the leaves, taking the way they will follow, Octobers and years from now. This year the poems came back when the leaves fell. Kicking the leaves, I heard the leaves tell stories, remembering and therefore looking ahead and building the house of dying. I looked up into the maples and found them, the vowels of bright desire. I thought they had gone forever. While the bird sang, I love you, and shook its black head from side to side, and its red eye with no lid, through years of winter, cold as the taste of chicken wire, the music of cinder block. Kicking the leaves, I uncover the lids of graves. My grandfather died at 77 in March, when the sap was running. And I remember my father, 20 years ago, coughing himself to death at 52 in the house in the suburbs. Oh, how he flung leaves in the air, how they tumbled and fluttered around us like slowly cascading water when we walked together in Hamden before the war, when Johnson's Pond had not surrendered to houses, the two of us hand in hand, and in the wet air the smell of leaves burning. And in 6 years, I will be 52. Now I fall, now I leap and fall, to feel the leaves crush under my body, to feel my body buoyant in the ocean of leaves, the night of them, night heaving with death and leaves rocking like the ocean. Oh, this delicious falling into the arms of leaves, into the soft laps of leaves. Face down, I swim into the leaves, feathery, breathing the acrid odor of maple, swooping in long glides to the bottom of October, where the farm lies curled against winter, and soup steams the breath of onion and carrot onto damp curtains and windows. And past the windows, I see the tall, bare maple trunks and branches, the oak with its few brown, feathery, remnant leaves, and the spruce trees holding their green. Now I leap and fall, exultant, recovering from death, on account of death, in accord with the dead, the smell and taste of leaves again, and the pleasure, the only long pleasure of taking a place in the story of leaves.
This recording was used with the assistance and permission of webofstories.com, the English-based archive of some of the great voices of our time. Thank you for listening to Michigan Writers on the Air. My thanks to Marty Link, Carrie Noga, and Fleeta Brown. Also, kudos to Daniel Wanchua for his skillful engineering and production work on this show. This program is a production of Interlochen Public Radio. Be sure to listen next time to Michigan Writers on the Air on IPR News Radio. Until then, this is Aaron Stander wishing you great writing, great reading, and the best of all words.